Good evening. My name's Jan Rothschild. I direct Duff's. Welcome to the Duff's Poetry Series. It's my pleasure to be able to introduce David Carkeet to you tonight. This is his first time reading at Duff's, and in fact, he just told me it's his second reading, but he is no newcomer to the literary scene at all. He's been recognized with the James D. Fellon Award in Literature in 1976, with an Edgar nomination by the Mystery Writers of America for his first novel, Double Negative, in 1981, with an O. Henry Award for his story, The Greatest Slump of All Time, which he will read tonight, and a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship in 1983. His stories have been published in Kansas Quarterly, Carolina Quarterly, North American Review, and others. He's also published scholarly articles in College English, Glossa, Language and Style, American Literature, and American Literary Realism. Double Negative was published by Dial Press and in paperback by Penguin. His latest novel, The Greatest Slump of All Time, which grew out of the story that he will read tonight, has just been released by Harper & Row, and he's going to be giving a book signing, by the way, at Paul's Books on April 7th. What time, David?
2 to 5.
And he teaches English at UMSL and has taught there since 1973. He teaches linguistics and creative writing. So here's David Carkeet.
Since you don't have this in front of you, I want to say a few words about it. It's about a 40-minute read. It's about a depressed baseball team. And it's divided into several sections. Just to give you a brief preview, the first section opens with a conversation between my pitcher, whose name is Apples, and the first baseman, E.T.A. Whitaker, in a hotel coffee shop. The second scene opens with a conversation between the first baseman and the shortstop, whose name is Scrappy, and that issues into a brief introduction to all the players. The third section is a more detailed introduction to all the players. I hope they get it out of their system before I say. The next section shows my catcher calling home to talk to his parents. And in the next section, my center fielder is playing with his young daughter, Tina, and listening to his wife on the phone and pondering his marriage. The next section opens with a conference on the mound during a playoff game. A little refresher. It's a 5-game series, so the first team to win 3 games wins the playoffs and then goes on to the World Series. So this is a crucial game for them. And the next to last section is a conversation in the locker room among the baseball players. And finally, the last section opens with a brief summary of the outcome of the first 6 games of the World Series, issuing then into the 7th and last game of the World Series, and the story concludes with the conclusion of that game. The greatest slump of all time. Apples Bagwell loses it in the late innings. His shoulders slump, his curve hangs, and his fastball yawns. Into the 7th or 8th, he is great, almost perfect, but then he loses it. And it always takes Gramek a few more base runners than it should to come out from the dugout and mumble around the mound and finally signal to the bullpen. Apples comes off the field looking like a puppy about to be whipped and sighs into the dugout. He just fills that dugout with his sigh. People talk about it. He gets tired, some say. He has a fear of losing, say others, remembering his early years in the bigs. Some believe he becomes overconfident and lets up. The profile is baffling. Late innings, a lead, a stunning performance through 6 or 7 frames. E.T.A. Whitaker, a bespectacled first baseman with a good mind and a social worker for a wife, finally figures it out. He takes Apples to breakfast, choosing a secluded booth at the rear of the hotel coffee shop. "Tough game last night," E.T.A. says to Apples as he gives his menu to the waitress. "For you, I mean." Apples lost his stuff in the 7th, but Butch came in and picked up the win. The team is only 3 games out now, with a month of the regular season left. "Yeah," says Apples. "Gramek should have left you in," Apples says the waitress, who is buxom and toothy. "He should have let you work it out. You're the best." Apples shrugs, and a pitiful look, one familiar to ETA of late, crosses his face. "She likes you, you know," says ETA, testing his new theory after the waitress has gone. Apples looks down at the table. His eyelids are heavy, his cheeks pale and lifeless. Let Jaime have her, he says without feeling. Jaime is their right fielder. He has an unquenchable lust for women and an active English vocabulary of 65 words. He has, says ETA. She told him she wants you. Apple sighs and sinks deeper into gloom. ETA says, the writers are talking about you for the Cy Young Award this year, Apples. Great, says Apples. His face doesn't say great. Someone watching from across the room would think he was recalling famous airline disasters. We're all really happy for you, says ETA, the whole team. And then, twisting the knife, we all love you, Apples, deeply. We really do. It works. Apples begins to sob. His face turns into a contorted mass of red flesh under his hands. The waitress, who has brought his pineapple pancakes, sees what is happening and thinks he is upset about last night's game. She crawls into the next booth, which is empty, and leans over him from behind and begins to knead his shoulders like a trainer, whispering comforting words into his ear. ETA watches with pity, which he begins to notice with concern is mixed with self-pity. Success depresses him, ETA says to shortstop Scrappy Hawthorne as they walk back to the third baseline after a warm-up run. Give him praise and he crumbles. On the mound, he sees a victory coming and he folds. He's afraid of winning. That don't make no sense, says Scrappy. Unlike ETA, who is a modern athlete in every sense and an interviewer's delight, Scrappy talks like a Coolidge-era ball player. I didn't think so at first either, says ETA, but then I saw that if you think you're inferior, being good at things will only make you feel like more of a bum. Scrappy frowns and turns to him. Apples feels like a bum? ETA nods. They have reached the baseline and turn to run the 12 paces again, gliding easily with synchronized strides. As they slow and turn to walk back, ETA says, maybe deep down we all think we're bums. After all, you know yourself better than anyone else does, Scrappy. You know how stupid and cruel you can be. Heap success on top of that, you got a real formula for the blues. He pats Scrappy on the fanny, and they turn and run once more. ETA slows to a stop and turns, but Scrappy continues running in a wide arc and jogs back to the dugout alone. ETA, temporarily relieved by their talk, plays well that day. Scrappy goes 0 for 5. In the field, twice he trips over second base as he tries to make unassisted double plays, and twice his throw sails wide of ETA's desperate reach. His second throw is much more cautious, and much worse, than the first. And then in the ninth, Scrappy instinctively dives to his right to make an impossible game-ending catch of a line drive, his body stretched out straight as a javelin. The cheers rain down on him in the clubhouse. That night, he has trouble falling asleep. He wakes before dawn and stares at the ceiling until it is time for breakfast, when he must go into society and be congratulated again. The next day, Scrappy shares his inarticulate thoughts with Bubba Phelps, the second baseman. Bubba laughs, without sympathy, and apparently without understanding, and then commits a judgment error in the field, and later is picked off first base, a base given to him not on the merits of a hit, but because he was too slow, too torpid, too sodden with thought to move out of the way of a high inside pitch that grazed him on the arm. All day and then at night, Bubba sees that pitch again and again, only it is higher, heading for his face, and he's even slower to get out of its way. To ease his mind, Bubba raps with Eddie Johnson, the swift center fielder. Eddie gives him wisdom and comfort. Later, when the team's flight is delayed by a mechanical problem, Eddie smashes two metal chairs in the airport lounge in a fit of impatience. He unburdens himself to his teammates in the outfield, Buford, Ellenbogen, and Jaime, and from Buford, the word travels back into the infield to the fast-talking third baseman, Frank Joyner. Frank gives it to Narvel Adams, the catcher, and in no time at all, Narvel is matching battery mate Apples, sigh for sigh. As the days wear on and the players collectively bring the team into first place, their symptoms diversify and specialize. Apples, of course, is the chief mumbler and moper. He has polished his flatness of affect beyond improvement. Between innings of work, Gramick, a former pitching coach, criticizes and corrects him, telling him to bear down, goddammit, and push off the bejesus mound. Apples listens and feels each word adding measurable weight to his body. When he returns to the mound, his motion is even more ponderous than before. Frank is different. Frank plays well at third and looks normal, but his mind is full of spiders. He thinks people are talking about him. On the road, he lurks just inside the door of his hotel room, listening to his teammates going down to breakfast, wondering why they haven't asked him to join them. He hears words that could be about him, words like am and my. And he aches for acceptance. Narvel sighs a lot. This makes him lightheaded and dizzy. Though only 24, he concludes that his body is deteriorating. 2 years, maybe three, and he'll announce his retirement. Bubba fears someone is going to break into his apartment on a dark night while he is in bed. The intruder will, of course, steal from him, but he will also abuse him with words. Bubba feels that the man will have every right to do this. Eddie compares himself with others and comes out subhuman. The way Scrappy runs the bases, the way Jaime goes back on the long ball, he can't match them. He doesn't belong in the majors. Every day he's ashamed to see his name still on his locker. Scrappy can't sleep. He awakens at 4 every morning as if called by God. He lies awake and stares, then lurches in bed as if having sex with the air. Then he stares some more. His afternoon naps debilitate him further. The sleep he loses at night is unrecoverable. Buford, once featured in the hometown newspaper for the way he ate 6 entrees in succession at a Denny's, has lost his appetite. ETA scowlingly maintains that the entire world has gone right to hell in a cardboard suitcase, and Jaime, newly impotent, is exploring suicide. Narvel calls home. His mother answers and calls with elderly enthusiasm to his father, who picks up the extension in the Ratskeller. Narvel, how are you, boy? Fine, Dad. Say, you guys are looking good. I mean good. A steady climb into first, tough resolve in the face of challenge, a widening lead in the division. I like the looks of it. I like it a lot. I like the whole pattern of the season. Another week of the same, and I'd say you're uncatchable. I'd definitely say you're uncatchable. Of course, I'm assuming lively run production from Eddie and a little more pizzazz in your starters, especially Apples. Nice play last night on that bad throw, by the way. Narvel blinks heavily. His father is retired and lives for the game. This once gave Narvel pleasure. How are you? Asks Narvel. He knows his conversation is lifeless. He never could talk, not well, anyway. Us, his father says loudly. Fine, fine, not bad for old folks. Your mom's back is giving her some trouble. I'm sorry, Narvel begins to say. It's nothing, says his mother. Narvel, do you remember Mrs. Webster? No, says Narvel. The Sunday school teacher? No, I don't. He was too young, Ruth, says his father. She passed away, says his mother, ending the tale. Huh, says Narvel. There's a long silence after this. Then he says, Mom, Dad, do you remember an old diary I kept when I was little? Nah, says his father. Of course, says his mother. It's in the trunk in the attic. Her voice is chipper and sing-songy. Narvel, she continues, do you remember Mrs. Graham? Jesus, he thinks, another corpse. No, I don't. Listen, Mom, can you send me that diary? Of course, she says. Getting sentimental, boy, says his father suspiciously. Seems to me you ought to be thinking of the future, not the past, like tomorrow's doubleheader. Those guys will eat you for lunch if you let them. Yes, sir, he says, feeling reprimanded. His throat tightens and his voice thins out. It's just that a bunch of us were talking about our childhoods and all, and I got wondering about mine and if it was, well, you know, what it was like and all. And I thought maybe the diary would help. Because lately, of course, dear, I'll put it in the mail right away. Narvel sighs in misery. His mother, as always, cooperates without understanding. The future's for the living, Narvel, his father says. You guys have been looking pretty drab for a front runner. Maybe it's our TV, Ralph. Ever since they built that high-rise, I know a drab team when I see one, his father insists. Do you hear me, Narvel? Talk to me. Yes, sir, he says, sighing again. His father understands but gives no support. Narvel suddenly sees himself as a soldier wounded in battle. His parents try to help him back to safety, but they arrive with a corpse mangled from almost calculated mishandling. Eddie plays with his daughter, Tina, and listens to his wife on the telephone. She's talking to Bubba's wife, making plans for the World Series. The playoffs start tomorrow, and already she's planning for the series. His resentment is like a cloak that warms him and darkens his life. He pulls it around himself, tighter and tighter. She has come to expect satisfaction. She is never surprised when they win. She will never see his achievement for what it is, not just a well-paying job, but a glorious, precarious moment of trembling balance, an injury or a brief slump turning into a long one because he gives it too much thought. Either of these could close it out, turn him into a regular guy with nothing more than a year or two of interesting history becoming less interesting as the years go by, and a bitch for a wife, because all baseball is to her is lots of money and a chance to shop in New York during the series. She, who has never touched a baseball in her life, who sits with the other wives and cheers in ignorance, she still doesn't know what a hit is. If he flies out four times in a game, she will say he got four hits. She cannot know how good he is, neither can Tina, because she is so young. And when she is older, he imagines Tina's future, a product of his wife's unassisted bungling because he is on the road so much, knocked up with nine kids and no man, maybe, or maybe a good Christian who prays her bruises away while her man drinks and beats up on her, or maybe a radical feminist who uses her dead father in her speeches as an example of persistent racism in the U.S. because in spite of his brains, there was no room for him in baseball management after it came to an end for him in his third year because of an injury or a slump that he gave too much thought to. A conference on the mound. It is a key game, the fourth game of the playoffs. After taking the first two from Chicago, they have dropped one and fear dropping this one. Chicago would then have the momentum and would be strong for the fifth game. They are at home, up by one in the top of the ninth. After a disputed call on a dive by Eddie for a ball hit behind second, ruled and out, Apples has hit a batsman who stole second on the next pitch, intentionally walked a batter, and given up an infield single, a ludicrously topped ball that dribbled nowhere in particular and advanced everybody. What that means is it's hard to keep track of these things. The bases are loaded and there's one out, okay? Top of the ninth, key game. The bases are loaded. Apples is down, but no more than usual. Narvel shuffles out to him. Apples welcomes the rebuke implied by his approach. The infield moves to the mound. Narvel looks at their faces and sees ghosts. What are we going to do? Asks Apples. They all look down at their feet and kick at the dirt on the mound. I don't know, man, says Bubba. Don't let him hit to me. I'm blue. And I'm tired, says sleepless Scrappy. Make him pull it. The others look up at the batter to see if he's right or left-handed. They should know this already without having a look, but they don't concentrate. He's a switch hitter, and he will bat left-handed against Apples. If he does pull the ball sharply, it will go to ETA at first. They turn to him, and he shrugs. Sure, he says. He says indifferently, I can handle it. And if I don't, he flashes a macabre grin, and his eyeglasses twinkle in the sunlight. What does it matter? Everyone here will just be dead someday. He sweeps his eyes over the field and then up to the stands filled with hopeful supporters. His teammates follow his eyes up to the stands and suddenly find themselves surrounded by 60,000 skeletons. There are people dying every day, Narvel says thoughtfully. People you don't even know. Whatever happens, says Apples, and a quiet urgency in his voice draws their close attention. I want you guys to know I've really appreciated your support this year. This is received glumly by all but ETA. He laughs loudly. Jesus, Apples, what do you do when you're thirsty? He says, drink ashes? The infield begins to chuckle grimly, and a dark figure approaches. Narvel sees him out of the corner of his eye and fancies it is the Grim Reaper, but it is only the home plate ump. He tells him to stop clowning around and play ball. Meekly, guiltily, they obey. Two things happen that decide it. First, Apples forgets there is already one out. The disputed call and subsequent hit batsmen have blurred in his mind into just one hitter. So he pitches with no expectation of victory. With the bases loaded and nobody out, he thinks Chicago's bound to take it away from them. And then after the loss tomorrow, he can stay home in bed for 5 months. He puts the ball right where he should. Second, ETA gets mad. As he crouches at first base with Apple's pitch and watches the switch hitter, he's reminded of a minor league coach who tried to make him into a switch hitter, ruining his average for a full year and slowing his rise to the major leagues. ETA complained about it frequently and got a bad rap as a troublemaker. And when the coach got reassigned somewhere, ETA resumed his left-handed hitting and left the farm the next season. But for the misery he caused him with his ignorance, that coach nearly destroyed his career. In rage, ETA whirls and guns the ball to second even before he knows he has fielded it cleanly. And in the same motion, he's on his way back to first to cover because he knows Apples won't make it, and he takes Scrappy's low return throw out of the dirt to his right, stretching his leg as if convinced that to tear something in it is to tear that coach's heart out. And the ump's call and the cheers from the stands send him and his team to the World Series. It has been asked if it is possible for a team to win the big one without a big stick, or with a bullpen that is weak, or with rookies at the corners. A related question that has not been asked is if it is possible for a team to win the big one with an outfield on Ellaville. Poppin' pills again, asks Gramick as he walks through the clubhouse and sees Buford and Eddie comparing prescriptions. Eddie protests that it is legal. They're not uppers, he says. They're anti-downers. Gramick shakes his head in silence and stalks off to his office, feeling that he just doesn't understand his boys anymore. He's tried his bench, hoping that platooning his regulars would get them out of the doldrums, but as soon as his bench performs well, they go logy on him too. So he sticks with his starters. If he's going to put 9 zombies on the field, he wants it to be his best 9. Scrappy, who is in sit-down psychotherapy, challenges Eddie's treatment. He says that the outfielders will never truly know themselves if they rely solely on drugs. Know thyself, said Abe Lincoln, Scrappy informs him. He knew his self, you can bet. Like you, Eddie asks mockingly. Well, I'm working on it, Scrappy says, with a tentativeness bordering on total capitulation. It takes time. Yeah, how much time? Scrappy's eyes shift nervously. A year, maybe. Maybe longer. Eddie laughs loudly. I got a lot of issues to work through, says Scrappy. Issues, says Eddie. Issues of what? The sporting news? What kind of word is that, you dirt brain? His words surprise everyone. Though big, black, and witty, Eddie has never been the club razzer. That was always Narvel's role, at least before he forgot how to talk. Scrappy's face collapses and he begins to whine his arguments out. He says that drugs just cover up the sickness. Eddie says that if the sickness is bad only because of the symptoms, and if drugs take away the symptoms, then it's a harmless disease. It's as harmless, he says, as being allergic to moon dust. It makes no difference if you never go there. Frank has been oiling his glove nervously and listening. He speaks up in a speedy, jerky way that is like his lateral movement at third base. Scrappy's right. He's just got the wrong kind of therapy. What is your guy, an analyst? I don't know, says Scrappy. Well, how often do you go? Once a week. Frank purses his lips. Maybe not then. But he wants me to come 3 or 4 times a week, says Scrappy. Ah, says Frank. Does he ever talk about the here and now? Scrappy looks deeply uncertain. You know, what's going on in your life today, Frank explains. Nah, says Scrappy. He's more, I don't know, interested in preschool, I guess. Yeah. Yeah, Frank says knowingly. You got the wrong persuasion, Scrappy. You should get into cognitive therapy. What's that? Asks ETA, who has joined the group. It's clean and simple, says Frank. People get depressed because they have bad thoughts about themselves. Cognitive therapy helps the patient see that these thoughts are distortions of reality. Like if Jaime here thought he was a for shit ball player, if I was his therapist, I'd remind him of his record for doubles last year and the catch he made on Frawley's ball last week. Stuff like that. Jaime smiles, happy to be discussed this way. And it works, asks Eddie, his eyebrows dancing. He looks right at Frank, into the soul of his depression. Well, it's working, says Frank. Eddie snorts and says, what if the bad thoughts are true? Like Jaime's batting average is way down this year. And he lost us the third game of the playoffs on that pansy throw. What does a therapist do when there's evidence that the patient is a washout? Jaime has stopped smiling. Frank is not prepared for this argument. Maybe he kind of puts things in perspective, he says tentatively, gesturing broadly with his hands, hands that have been called soft for the way they absorb ground balls. Eddie snorts again. If you're throwing away money on a shrink like that, you better hope we win the series, and you better help us, like by improving your bunting, for God's sake. It stinks. Did your guy tell you that? I'm just trying to get better, Frank says weakly. He's not talking about his bunting. ETA has observed this dialogue closely. Eddie's anger surprises him. He remembers his own flash of hatred for his old coach in the last game of the playoffs. He looks at Apples, Narvel, and the others. Their self-hatred is suddenly as obvious to him as it would be if they were systematically mutilating their bodies with their cleats. "Listen up, guys," he calls out with a hint of his old hopefulness. Heads turn. The faces are pale and listless, but they are interested. He speaks. His theory is simple. Depression, he says, is hatred of others turned inward. It is anger unreasonable only in its direction. We're like a little boy whose parents have yelled at him, so he kicks his dog, he says, his hand darting nervously up to adjust his glasses. Only we're the dog. We're kicking ourselves. Buford asks him how he gets from anger to depression. They seem to him to be different emotions. ETA, suddenly losing all faith in his position, says he doesn't know. Maybe it makes no sense, he admits, and maybe no one is mad at anybody he can think of, at least not right now, but all he's asking is that they give it some thought. Not necessarily right now, but I hate my wife, Eddie announces matter-of-factly. He looks at Scrappy, Jaime, and Frank. He has hurt them, too, he sees, along with himself. His eyes moist, he says to each of them, "Hey, man. Hey, man." "It's okay," Scrappy says softly. "I hate someone," says Narvel, banging his fist into his palm. "I know I do. I can feel it." His words are followed by a long silence. It is the first time he has spoken in 2 days. "When I was a kid," Bubba says suddenly, "this other kid who was older and a lot bigger than me used to wait for me and beat me up on my way to school. He had a whip, too, and sometimes they used that. He waited for me every day." "Well, I was an army kid," says Frank. "We moved around a lot, so I was switching schools all the time. It seemed like I'd never studied what the other kids had, so I was always behind. Couldn't draw or sing, either. The teachers always found me handy as a negative example, and they'd talk about me all the time in front of the other kids." He pauses and then says with a dreamy smile, "I hate a whole shitload of people." The players form a tighter circle and continue to talk. Gramek steps out of his office and opens his mouth to ask Narvel something about the New York lineup. The words don't come out. He squints at his team, all hunched up together and muttering why he thinks they're as isolated and freaky as a bunch of Christian athletes in Bible study. They win the first, third, and fifth games of the World Series on skill, instinct, and constructive anger. They lose the second, fourth, and sixth games in the fog of depressive relapses. The pattern has not gone unnoticed, and the sports writers, ignorant of the pathology, pursue a mathematical whimsy and predict victory for them in Game 7. The players themselves do not know what to expect or what to hope for. For a baseball team sickened by success, winning the World Series is definitely contraindicated. They wonder if, during the game, they will sabotage victory if they see it coming. But then perhaps a win is just the thing they need. How nice, how ensuring to have reached the absolute top. Good material for a cognitive therapist, that. And they are getting madder every day. Old angers grow stronger. Eddie, for example, is divorcing his wife and seeking custody of Tina. And new angers erupt. Jaime has decided that he hates women. And the nervousness his discovery arouses in the clubhouse is offset by the team thrill and the knowledge that the entire outfield, in spite of their medication, is now mad as hell. Apples and Narvel are the only ones left to make progress. They have been slow, as ETA puts it, to get in touch with their anger. But even this changes for the good in the 11th hour, at least for Apples. During a live radio interview in the dugout before the seventh game, the normally placid pitcher flushes with sudden annoyance at a prying question, and as he looks back at the badly dressed broadcaster who has been tailing them all season, he recalls that it was this same man who once described him as a tall, skinny, loosey-goosey kind of pitcher. And while Apples knows that this describes his motion rather well, he resents the implication of awkwardness and ugliness. After all, that waitress back at the hotel wanted him, didn't she? He suddenly feels that the press has never dealt with him fairly, always suggesting that because he doesn't look like a pitcher, he probably isn't one. He responds to the question, not even remembering what it is, with a flurry of obscenity that leaves the broadcaster speechless. The interview is carried over the radio speakers in the clubhouse, and those players still there tying their shoelaces or looking at themselves with ambivalence in the mirror hear the words in astonishment and send out a cheer for their hurler. As for Narvel, it is obvious from the way he returns Apple's fiery warm-up throws that he's still blue. The team sees it. ETA, chewing on the bitterness of his minor league experience, knows the joy of rage, and he wants Narvel to know it too. So when the game starts, he directs his encouraging chatter away from Apples to the catcher, saying, "Come on, babe. Come on, Narvel, babe. Come on. Come on, babe. Come on, Narvel, babe. Get mad, babe. Come on." And Scrappy, who has been watering with tears and ancient anger toward the incompetent and belittling grandmother who reared him, yells, "Work on it, Narvel, work on it, work on it." And Frank at third interrupts a steady stream of soft curses at a grade school teacher who said his painted trees in art class looked like apple cores to shout, "Who do you hate, Narv? Who do you hate? Who do you hate?" Narvel accepts the encouragement gratefully. The game seems to proceed almost without him. He drops a few balls, but nobody's hurt. He gives some bad signs, but Apples just shakes them off. And he makes a bad throw on an attempted steal, but it's backed up by swift, dry-mouthed Eddie, who charges in from center and throws the runner out as he tries to advance to third. The game remains scoreless, the only threat coming from long balls hit to the wall in fury by Eddie, Frank, and ETA. New York has barely touched the ball because Apples is hot, giving up just two hits, bloop singles into the bottom of the seventh. His cheeks are flaming red, and he gets hotter as he moves through his fateful innings. He imagines he is pitching over and over to the radio broadcaster, and he rejoices. He rejoices in his enemy's repeated failures at bat. In the top of the ninth, back-to-back doubles by Bubba and Jaime give them a one-run lead. Both hits are line drives to the wall on the fly, clotheslines, ropes. It happens so quickly that they are ahead before they have time to think about it. A relief pitcher enters the game for New York, and while he takes his warm-up throws, each of the next three batters waits and watches, alone with his thoughts. It is the top of the ninth, after all, and the more runs they score, the more likely they are to win. When play resumes, Eddie and Scrappy promptly strike out. ETA fares even more poorly. Remembering his minor league coach and wishing to prove himself once and for all, he bats right-handed for the first time in 8 years. He ignores Gramek's baffled shouts from the dugout, and after two swinging strikes, he makes contact but is called out for several of the most ignominious reasons in the rule book. His weak undercut sends the ball straight up, spinning madly but rising no more than 5 feet. As it drops back down, it strikes his bat as it swings around in an awkward follow-through. The ball squirts down the first baseline where it is struck again by his bat, which has slipped out of his unaccustomed... right-handed grip, and then the ball is kicked by his foot as he stumbles out of the batter's box. The ump says he is out. The opposing catcher adds, "And then some." ETA takes his position in the field, gloating with a strange sense of revenge. In the bottom of the ninth, Apples retires the first batter on a pop-up to Frank that Narvel should have taken, but Frank and ETA have agreed to cover for Narvel because of his deep funk. The second batter hits a ball sharply down the line at third that rolls around in the left field corner. Buford, hungry and constipated, seems to take a day or two to come up with it, and he just barely holds him to a triple. The hometown crowd goes wild. That is, the New York crowd. They're playing an away game here, so the hometown crowd wants them to lose. The hometown crowd goes wild. The tying run is at third, because Apple's team is ahead by one run. Okay. Apples, expecting to lose now, whiffs the next batter on 3 pitches, and the visiting fans thunder with anticipation of the final series-winning out. Apples, expecting to win, walks the next batter on 4 pitches. He studies the runner's lead at first and remembers how the press has always criticized his pickoff move. He fires the ball to ETA, and the runner is safe by a wide margin. He goes into a stretch and fires again, making it a little closer. He hears Gramick yell something from the dugout, but ignores it. His third throw to ETA is wide, and ETA must come off the bag to take it. The tying run at third dances down the line, watching, itching to get home. Gramick is joined in his yelling by some fans behind the dugout. They shout, "Get the batter, Apples, get the last out." Unhappy with his last throw, Apples tries again and is pleased with the improvement. Yes, this is definitely a part of the game he needs to work on. No time like the present. He tries a slightly different motion, and ETA blocks the ball with his chest as it bounces up out of the dirt. Gramick jumps from the dugout, and a voice from the stands yells, "Tell the moron to forget about the runner and work on the batter, Gramick." The voice is familiar to Apples. It is a friend or relative of one of the players. And he smiles toward it and toward the approaching Gramick with blank indifference. Gramick chastises him further, waving violently to the rest of the infield to stay back from his mound. Apples sighs despondently and agrees to abandon his cause. And after getting the sign from Narvel, he delivers a lackluster pitch that is outside by a foot. And Narvel surprises everyone by coming up quickly from behind the plate to try to pick off the runner at first. He too, it seems, has become caught up in Apples' obsession. But the ball doesn't go to ETA at all. Instead, it screams over the dugout toward the fans in the stands. And there is a shout and a poang as it flies into the tin crate of a beer vendor, knocking him backwards into Narvel's mother's lap. One voice rises above the others. It is Narvel's father yelling, "What the hell are you doing, boy?" And beside him, Narvel's mother wipes spilled beer from her lap. The runner at first advances to second on the throw. The runner at third comes home, tying the score, and he says something unkind and jeering to Narvel. Narvel doesn't hear him. His mind is numb. His body tingles with satisfaction. The winning run at second is represented by a rookie, a pinch runner who nervously stands on one leg and grabs the ankle of the other, stretching his quadriceps. He chatters excitedly, and he reminds Bubba of the taunting teenage boy who always beat him up on his way to school. Now, when Apples, inspired by the team's declining fortune, gets the next batter to hit a ground ball to Bubba for an easy play at first, which will send the game into extra innings, Bubba guns the ball across the diamond to Frank at third in hopes of erasing the skinny bully once and for all. And though surprised, Frank takes the throw well, for he is good. His hands are soft. His cognitive therapist says so. And he comes within inches of tagging the sliding runner. In the cloud of dust, the call can go either way. But because Bubba's play was so stupid in the first place, the ump spreads his hands out wide and sticks his fanny up and yells, "He's there." The infield, agitated and without direction, draws together on the mound. ETA says, "Well, the run that will beat us is at third." "Yeah," says Frank, "we put him there too." "You a sport for saying we, Frank," says Bubba. "It was my fault all the way." "I put him on base to begin with," says Apple. "And I got him to second," says Narvel. ETA grins, a team effort. That's what we'll say to the press afterwards. Better yet, we'll let Apples tell them. They all chortle, producing a cacophonous death rattle that reaches the fans in the first few rows and chills their hearts. "It's funny," continues ETA. "You'd think depressed people wouldn't want to be around other depressed people, but we seem to get along all right. I think it's even been good for team spirit." "You didn't start this on purpose, did you, ETA?" asked Bubba. "Just to bring us together? You wouldn't do that, would you, man?" "He couldn't have," says Apples. "He didn't start it. I did." "But he put it into words," says Bubba. "He made it contagious." "Nobody started it," Frank says firmly. "It just happened. We were all ripe." "Maybe everybody's ripe." Scrappy nods slowly. "Ain't it a bitch the way it takes hold of you? And it's never over, is it? Even when you think you're getting better." "It's never over until it's over," says Narvel. As the infield pauses to ponder this, the ump steps out and rudely orders them to break it up. As he turns his back, he receives a blistering chorus of illegal epithets. Their anger is like a pitching machine gone wild, spraying the ballpark with vengeful sallies. The ump flinches, but keeps walking to the plate. He should eject them all, but he lets it pass, his judgment dulled by 9 innings of Narvel's sighing listlessness at his feet. In mutual consolation for their season in hell together, and to warm one another for the long, cold off-season ahead of them, the infield forms a hugging circle and squeezes hard. With a moaning cheer, they break the circle and return to their positions. Apples bends down and picks up the rosin bag. He wants to give this one some thought, and the rule book says that with a man on base, a pitcher may take as long as he likes. Meanwhile, at third, Frank and the rookie pinch runner chat, as opposing players will do even under the most tense of circumstances. The rookie, grown cocky with his progress to third base and his instant national importance, asks Frank why his club is so weird. Apple's delay behind the mound gives Frank ample opportunity to speak about the suffering of his team. He describes the symptoms and possible origins of clinical depression, stressing his team's particular nemesis, the psychic perils of success. Frank understands the problem well and speaks about it intelligently and convincingly. The upshot of their discussion is that when Apples finally goes into his stretch and looks at the rookie at third and sighs so heavily that he balks, thus automatically scoring the runner, who must trot home and touch the plate to end the game, a formality, but a necessary formality, the rookie base runner freezes in uncertainty at third base.